Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. This Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on a shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with the schedule of English language broadcast or a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Sputnik Radio, Spanish National Radio, Radio Havana Cuba, and NHK World Radio Japan. We will begin with Russia's Sputnik Radio. Afshin Ratansi spoke with journalist Matt Taibbi. They discussed the state of the American press, drones under Biden, the possibility of prison and police reform, whether AOC and Bernie will have impact in the new administration, Middle East policy, and what Biden will do to, quote, make Putin pay, unquote. Sputnik Radio.
Joining me now from New Jersey is Rolling Stone's Matt Taibbi.
What leads the news is dictated by, you know, a handful of people in New York, Washington, and L.A. who run the biggest news organizations. As we saw, once again, with these results, the press and the political class have a bit of a disconnect in terms of understanding where most people are in this country.
And when it comes to the existential threat, say, of climate change, all these people celebrating a Biden victory, what do they think is going to happen vis-a-vis fracking under a Biden presidency?
The assumption that you get from Democrats when you ask about that issue is, well, no matter what, he'll be better than Trump, right? Which is kind of the blanket response to almost any policy issue when you get right down to it. But there isn't a whole lot of evidence in the background of this type of Democrat that's occupied the head of the party since the Clinton years, that they're really very strong on environmental issues, and they're always going to listen to their donors ahead of other people on issues like that. I wrote a couple of features about drones, and I didn't really start doing that until the Trump years. Drone strikes did go up under Trump. If the people who are rumored to be going back into the national security establishment end up taking those places, I think we can assume that there's going to be some continuity with the Obama era policies, which is where the drone program, the lethal action programs, as they like to call them, I think they're probably going to continue. And we just won't hear about them very much because the press is not likely to pay a lot of attention.
Michael Moore, the great filmmaker, has been tweeting about Kamala Harris. Can we assume that Vice President Harris will not now be advocating the locking up of innocent people for prison labor like she did in California?
Well, have to remember who the president is. I mean, Joe Biden was one of the primary authors of the 1994 crime bill, which was a kind of signature moment in the history of mass incarceration in this country. He certainly didn't have the reputation of being any kind of advocate for criminal justice reform heading into this election cycle. The political winds have changed somewhat, and both Harris and Biden have adopted the pose of people who are going to be on the side of criminal justice reform. But I think looking back at their history, it would be unwise to expect that to happen.
But what are you detecting from, say, people like AOC and Sanders as shots across the bow, as warning shots for Biden-Harris?
A major subplot of what happened in the last election cycle was, you know, the kind of dismantling and neutering of the Sanders opposition. They were in position to win the nomination. Sanders was the leading fundraiser, which was a tremendous political development because it was a proof of a concept that nobody thought was possible, competing without corporate money. And yet Sanders in the end was beaten rather badly, and he performed worse than he did in 2016, which has taken a lot of the sales out of that movement. We don't see a whole lot of evidence of that coalition putting pressure on Biden yet. They might But so far, we're not seeing a whole lot of that.
You write, I can't breathe. Will we see defunding of the police?
I don't know. I don't think that Joe Biden is particularly a fan of defunding the police. I actually don't think most Americans, frankly, are fans of defunding the police. I think almost everybody agrees that there has to be a significant reform of police. Are we going to see a whole lot of that? It's hard to say. But a lot of those issues are at the state level and not federal. So it'll be difficult to enact it from the White House.
The journalists have been good at covering the human rights abuses by the Trump administration when it came to immigration and so forth. How sure can we be that these elite journalists are going to be covering violations of the UN Charter that are enacted by Biden-Harris?
My primary worry about what took place in the last 4 years and what we have to think about going forward is that the press has changed radically in the United States during the Trump era. We've seen a shift towards most corporate news organizations essentially being proxies for the Democratic Party. And they justified that on the grounds of we have to oppose Donald Trump. But now the Democrats are going to be assuming the White House. How do you go back to being a press that challenges people in power? I think it's very, very difficult to take that step once you've taken, you know, the step backwards into a more politicized media.
What is going to be U.S. policy vis-a-vis Israel, and how will that impact on any possible Biden policies on Iran, on Afghanistan, on Syria, crucially?
Again, I just don't think that there's going to be a significant change or deviation from the kind of standard neoliberal policy, the democracy promotion foreign-based foreign policy. The Syria hawks are probably going to be much more empowered under a Biden administration. The relationship with Israel is going to remain preeminent, although there is a movement, a progressive movement, to stand behind the Palestinians somewhat in the Democratic side. It's not enough to tilt the policy of the Democratic Party, not yet. I just wouldn't expect a major change there. I do think that Syria, there's going to be more aggressive posture towards Syria than there was under Trump.
And Trump, of course, he expelled Russian diplomats. He destroyed the START nuclear proliferation, non-proliferation treaties. He put troops on Russia's borders. And Biden still said Putin has to pay. So another existential question, arguably. What do you think Biden meant by Putin has to pay? What's he going to do?
I would expect the Democratic Party, once they occupy the White House, to undertake a series of measures that will be largely performative in terms of looking like they're standing up to Russia, whether that's, you know, in Ukraine, whether it's expelling more diplomats in retaliation for what they're going to call election interference. But the people who are coming back into power are the same people who, you know, over the course of 20 years sought to have some kind of a relationship with Russia, often to combat terrorism. So I don't think it's to be excluded that there will be a softening in relations. A lot of the tension with Russia, it was political as a means of getting at Donald Trump. And now that he's out of power, you know, maybe things will improve on that score.
Matt Taibbi, thank you.
That interview was by Afshin Ratansi from his program called Going Underground on Sputnik Radio, the current name for the Voice of Russia, available online at rt.com. Next, Radio Exterior de España, or Spanish National Radio. Allison Hughes begins with Peru, where there have been 3 presidents in a week and deadly police repression. Climate change is increasing both rain and drought in Central America, with a record number of hurricanes forcing the poorest to leave their homes. Trump and the Senate have opened up bidding on land in the Alaskan Arctic Wildlife Refuge for oil drilling, which will destroy the preserve. Spanish National Radio.
To Peru, where lawmakers on Monday named the 76-year-old Francisco Sagasti as interim leader and caretaker president after the ousting of 2 presidents last week. From the centrist Morado party, Sagasti won enough votes to head Congress, which means he will constitutionally assume the presidency. National elections are scheduled for April 11th. Shortly after the vote, Sagasti stepped outside the Congress building in Lima, greeted the crowd, and remembered the violence and the two deaths that preceded him, saying, "Today is not a day of celebration. We cannot go back, bring them back to life, but we can take action from Congress, from the executive, so that this does not happen again. We have too many problems, too many tragedies to be celebrating." Less than 1 week after taking office as interim president, Manuel Merino was forced to resign or be impeached following the deaths of two demonstrators in a violent police crackdown of protests over the ouster of his predecessor in what amounted to a congressional coup. Former President Martin Vizcarra was removed from office over allegations of bribery, which he denies, and for which he hasn't been legally charged. Merino, the congressional spokesman, became interim president, promising to maintain the scheduled elections in April. Vizcarra is unaffiliated with any party and oversaw an anti-graft campaign that led to frequent clashes within Congress. He was in favor of stripping the lawmakers of their immunity from prosecution, something that made him popular with the Peruvian public. However, the protesters were not calling for his return to office. Rather, they were denouncing Merino and the Congress itself and chanted, "This Congress does not represent me." Thousands of demonstrators took part in some of the largest protests in decades in Peru following Vizcarra's ouster, with a national march on Thursday and another brutally repressed on Saturday. The mostly peaceful demonstrations heard hundreds of thousands of young people, workers, and university students chanting, "Merino out," and "They messed with the wrong generation," before police fired tear gas and live ammunition into the crowds. Two university students died from gunshot wounds, and over 100 other people were injured. Peru's National Human Rights Coordinator reports that at least 41 people are missing, and of the injured, at least 9 remain in hospital with gunshot wounds. In a televised speech on midday, Merino, the former head of the Congress who had led the push to impeach Vizcarra, asked his cabinet to remain in place to assist in the transition. He said, however, his resignation was irrevocable and called for peace and unity. Peruvians poured onto the streets to celebrate Merino's resignation, waving flags, chanting, and banging pots. After the violence on Saturday, all of Merino's cabinet ministers who'd been sworn in on Thursday offered their resignations. The calls for Merino's resignation grew on Sunday. The National Assembly of Peru's regional governments also demanded he leave, calling him politically responsible for the acts of violence. In his Twitter account, Vizcarra blamed the deaths on Merino's illegal and illegitimate government. Several human rights organizations in Peru have filed a complaint against Merino and a number of his foreign ministers for qualified homicide, serious injuries, and abuse of authority. Peru's new interim leader, Francisco Sagasti, told Congress on Monday, "We have a task ahead of us all to correct the legal framework to ensure that peaceful demonstrations can be held in all safety and at the same time be able to foresee any possible isolated acts of violence that should not be permitted in our country." Vizcarra was among the first to congratulate the new interim president, while he himself has taken his ouster to the Constitutional Court. Francisco Sagasti now faces the challenge of bringing some stability to Peru, a country with one of the highest death rates from the COVID-19 pandemic and facing its worst economic contraction in a century. The world's second largest copper producer, Peru is also on the sights of international markets anxious to protect their investments. Climate change is increasing the intensity of rain and drought throughout Central America. Last week, the UN Refugee Agency warned that extreme weather exacerbates the poverty, forcing families to flee their homes. The current hurricane season is providing especially damaging results. On Monday, Iota, a devastating Category 5 hurricane, bore down on a Central American coastal region still recovering from Hurricane Eta that hit 2 weeks ago. Iota pounded Nicaragua Monday night as a Category 4 storm. Guatemala, southern Mexico have also braced for more flooding, and the government of El Salvador has declared a red alert, suspending schools and activating emergency funds. The Honduran president called the storm a bomb, which is going to leave Honduras and all of Central America in a very difficult situation. The World Food Program warned that some 80,000 people in Nicaragua were at risk from Iota, while Honduran authorities said they were evacuating another 80,000. Local authorities and the Navy frantically tried to get thousands of families to higher ground or ports in the watery region of jungles, rivers, and coastline, which also straddles Honduras and took a direct hit from Eta. The unprecedented 2020 hurricane season comes as Central America is facing an economic crisis linked to the coronavirus pandemic, with experts warning the compounding hardship could worsen infections, spread hunger, and fuel a new round of migration from the region. Iota is the record 30th named storm of this year's Atlantic hurricane season. It's also the ninth storm to intensify rapidly this season, a dangerous phenomena that is happening increasingly more often. Climate change, scientists say, is the cause for these wetter, stronger, and more destructive storms. In the United States, the Trump administration has opened up bidding on lands in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for oil drilling. After nearly four decades of protection, in 2017, the Republican-led Congress voted to open up part of the refuge to oil development, leasing the lands to companies for exploitation and destroying the natural wildlife preserve. Conservation groups, concerned scientists, and environmentalists are highly critical of the move. President Trump, they say, is trying to ram the auction through before the January inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden, whose platform included advances toward conversion from fossil fuel dependence to renewable energy.
Those reports by Allison Hughes were from her weekly program called Panorama on Radio Exterior de España or Spanish National Radio. Spain may be heard at their website rtve.es and by podcast as REE. On to Radio Havana, Cuba. Luis Almagro, the Secretary General of the OAS, that's the Organization of American States, admitted his responsibility in the coup d'etat in Bolivia that forced President Evo Morales to be exiled from his country by falsely reporting that his election was corrupt. Two of the ministers installed by the coup president Jeanine Añez have escaped the country to avoid prosecution. Iran responded to threats from Trump to bomb its nuclear facilities, as was reported by the New York Times. On Wednesday morning, Israel bombed Iran-linked targets in Syria, killing Syrians and others. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Luis Almagro, the Secretary General of the Organization of American States, the OAS, has accepted his responsibility in the coup d'etat in Bolivia that caused the forced departure of the government of former President Evo Morales. In the book, Luis Almagro does not ask for forgiveness. The representative of the regional organization relates how he supported Morales to run for re-election in 2019 merely to gain his confidence. The text is the result of more than 100 interviews and 20 hours with Almagro, where he describes his political career. Amongst the most significant political facts that are related is the strategy to unseat Evo Morales, to convince the United States to ally itself with his position to go against the Venezuelan government or his support for Dilma Rousseff. The author of the book shows that Almagro's role in Evo Morales' exit was part of a premeditated strategy which began in 2017 and culminated with the OAS Electoral Observation Mission to present false irregularities in the vote count in 2019 and thus prevent the re-election of the president, which encouraged the military coup. The interim commander general of the Bolivian police, Johnny Aguilera, has announced that the former de facto ministers of government and defense, Arturo Murillo and Fernando Lopez, have fled the country. Murillo is reportedly in Panama and Lopez in Brazil. Aguilera told local media that Murillo and Lopez used a FAB-046 plane to reach Puerto Suarez on the Brazilian border and then headed in different directions. directions. The prosecutor's office had issued arrest warrants against Murillo and Lopez, the former ministers of Jeanine Añez, for the alleged crimes of influence abuse and for the purchase and use of lethal tear gas. Fernando Atanasio, a prosecutor in the case, announced on Tuesday that Interpol, the international police, will be asked to activate the blue seal against the ex-de facto ministers to confirm their locations. Iran has warned of a harsh response to any U.S. hostile action after a leading U.S. daily newspaper reported that President Donald Trump was considering an attack on Iranian nuclear facilities. Ali Rabai, Iran's government spokesman, made the comment on Tuesday in response to a New York Times report that Trump had asked his top aides about striking Iran's nuclear facilities. Quote, "It is highly unlikely that the Americans will seek to jeopardize the security of the region and the world because Iran's response to any aggression will be harsh and severe," Rabai told reporters. The Iranian official described the report as psychological warfare by Israel and classic opponents of the Islamic Republic. The American president reportedly floated the idea of the strikes last Thursday in a meeting with U.S. Vice President, the Secretary of State, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, plus other officials. The senior aides apparently dissuaded Trump by warning him that an attack on Iran could escalate into a broader conflict in the last weeks of his presidency. Playing down reports about Trump's intention to attack Iranian nuclear sites, a spokesman for Iran's permanent mission to the United Nations in New York said Iran will respond to any act of adventurism by its aggressors through its own military prowess. Syria's state news agency SANA Sana reported early on Wednesday that the air defense units of the Syrian army had successfully intercepted aggression from the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights that invaded the airspace of Damascus and reported a number of casualties. Although there were no official reports of casualties or damage, Syrian military sources told Sana that the assault had led to the martyrdom of three soldiers and the injuries of another. In a rare statement, the Israeli military confirmed that it had launched airstrikes on Syrian targets inside that Arab country. Israel frequently targets military positions inside Syria, especially those of the resistance movement Hezbollah, which has played a key role in aiding the Syrian army in its fight against foreign-backed terrorists. The Tel Aviv regime has been a main supporter of terrorist groups that have opposed the government of President Bashar al-Assad, erupting in Syria 9 years ago. In general, Israel remains silent about attacks on Syrian territories that many view as knee-jerk reactions to the Syrian government's increasing success in confronting its enemies in the country.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 5 p.m. to 11 at either 6000, 6060, 6100, or 6165. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could make a donation for production costs of this freely distributed program, I may be reached through the website and PayPal, or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Please, if you find this program beneficial, help support my efforts. Many, many thanks to those who have donated. We will conclude with NHK World Radio Japan. Protests against the monarchy in Thailand continue after lawmakers rejected reforms to the monarch's power, the military's political influence, and the removal of the prime minister. Japan, the United States, India, and Australia are holding another military drill in the Arabian Sea in an attempt to intimidate China. NHK Japan.
Turning to Thailand, where fresh protests erupted on the streets of Bangkok on Wednesday as lawmakers rejected a proposal to reform the monarchy. Many protesters are vowing they won't back down, despite an increasing police crackdown that's included water cannon and tear gas. Seven proposals were on the table in parliament on Wednesday. They approved two that would allow for discussion on revising the constitution, but nixed one that would potentially limit the monarchy's power. The outcome fell far short of the protesters' demands, which, aside from monarchy reform, includes curbing the military's political influence and the removal of the prime minister, a former army chief who initially came to power in a 2014 military coup. Protesters reacted by marching to the Royal Thai Police headquarters, spraying it with graffiti and paint.
It's not fair. They're not really listening to the people's voices. I'll find time to come to demonstrations until every one of our submitted demands has been met.
Wednesday's unrest comes after 55 people were injured during clashes on Tuesday. Protesters are vowing to forge on, with their next major event scheduled for later this month. Japan, the United States, India, and Australia are taking another step toward boosting defense cooperation. The so-called Squad countries are holding a maritime exercise for the second time this month in an apparent bid to check China's growing military presence in the region. Warships, submarines, and aircraft gathered in the Arabian Sea, west of India, on Tuesday for the second phase of the annual Malabar exercise. Indian Navy officials say it will last for 4 days and will include one aircraft carrier from their country and another from the U.S. The first phase of the drill took place in early November. Australia is taking part in the event for the first time in 13 years. It comes weeks after foreign ministers from the four countries met in Tokyo and agreed to help realize Japan's vision of a free and open Indo-Pacific region. The Arabian Sea is close to maritime shipping lanes linking Asia with the Middle East. China has stepped up maritime activities in the area, including by deploying submarines, as it promotes its Belt and Road Initiative. The Japanese government has decided to extend the Maritime Self-Defense Force's deployment in Middle East waters by another year. The mission is aimed at ensuring safe navigation for vessels related to Japan. Japan sent a destroyer and patrol aircraft for intelligence gathering amid ongoing regional tensions. Their role is classified as study and research activity under the ministry's establishment law. The initial one-year deployment, which was endorsed by the cabinet last year, will expire on December 26th. The government says it has decided to extend it for another year after studying the mission's activities, citing the need to continue intelligence gathering.
Those reports were from NHK Radio Japan. They are now heard from 8:30 to 9 p.m. at 6155-7245 and 7445, or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. All the times I announce are for Pacific Standard Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcast, get a global perspective. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows. Please consider making a safe donation online through PayPal. There's a link at my website, along with a podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. This shortwave report, which is now in its 24th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. This shortwave report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.